I am, excuse me, I am America. I'm the part you won't recognize, but get used to me. Black, confident, cocky, my name, not yours, my religion, not yours, my goals, my own, get used to me. Muhammad Ali said that, as you may have guessed. I am America, I am the part you won't recognize. So today it's been nearly 2 months since Muhammad Ali died at the age of 74 from complications of Parkinson's disease, which he had lived with for decades. It was really big news around the world. So big that I was kind of shocked. I really didn't know that it would be such a big deal in that ever ephemeral news cycle for more than a few minutes, because that's how long news seems to be news these days. But the tributes just kept coming in, more than 15 minutes later, more than a day later, more than a week later, nearly 2 months later, and people are still posting articles once in a while about things this man said or did that made him important in our lives. I wrote this little piece I'm getting ready to read to you a week after his death and posted it as my Facebook status. It's not perfect, but I haven't edited it for this sermon. So here's what I said. I've been thinking hard about Muhammad Ali. He was Black Lives Matter before Black Lives Matter was a thing. Unapologetic, in your face, unwavering. He was a Muslim convert who rejected his slave name and demanded to be known by the name his imam chose for him in Louisville, Kentucky, in the 1960s. Unapologetic, in your face, unwavering. He was a peacemonger who refused to fight in the empire's wars. Ain't no Viet Cong ever called me a bleeped expletive. Unapologetic, in your face, unwavering. He was the most fierce soul, the most gentle soul we ever loved. He was the greatest. And we really did love him. But why did America allow itself to unequivocally love this man? I really don't know. I want to unpack the complexities of it. I want to believe that the people we are when we love him is who we really are. I want to tap into that for every other human being who, like Ali, is Black or Muslim or disabled or from poverty or holds radical political ideals or. It gives me hope, this reverence at the death of this man we esteemed as a hero. Rest in peace and power, Muhammad Ali. You will keep making a difference for generations. We are better because of you. I want to talk about this. That was my post, and my friend and colleague, Charlie, responded to my words that day by posting a link to an article that was in The Nation by writer Dave Zirin. And in it, Zirin writes, "Full articles can and should be written about his complexities, his fallout with Malcolm X, his depoliticization in the 1970s, the ways the warmongers attempted to use him like a prop as he suffered in failing health. But the most important part of his legacy is that time in the 1960s when he refused to be afraid. As he said years later, some people thought I was a hero. Some people said that what I did was wrong, but everything I did was according to my conscience. I wasn't trying to be a leader. I just wanted to be free." Not the fight, the reverberations. They are still being felt by a new generation of people, Zirin writes. They ensure that the champ's name will outlive us all. Bill Russell said it best in 1967, "I'm not worried about Muhammad Ali. I'm worried about the rest of us." And there ends that article excerpt. "I'm worried about the rest of us." That was 49 years ago that Russell, a retired basketball legend and friend of Ali, said those words. And today he's 82, and I wonder if he's still worried about the rest of us. I feel a little heavy with the belief that he must be. But it's not all heaviness in my heart because, as I already shared, I'm curious, I'm optimistic, and really, really interested in the way that this nation has loved Muhammad Ali. Yeah, sure, we've sugarcoated his rough edges, the things about him that frighten us a little or a lot. And that glossing over is of the hard things, that glossing over the hard things is not always good. Sometimes it's dangerous. It's always complex. We are always complex. And yet remains the fact that with all of our complexities and with all of his complexities, we loved him. I want my nation to think about why and how we loved him. Over and over in my head, as I was writing this, was playing this song by one of my daughter's favorite bands, Bastille. And it's a love song, but it could be from my country to all of our people who do not fall into line but are part of us anyway. And it goes like this: when all of your flaws and all of my flaws are laid out one by one, a wonderful part of the mess that we made, we pick ourselves undone. All of your flaws and all of my flaws, they lay there hand in hand. Ones we've inherited, ones that we've learned, they pass from man to man. There's a hole in my soul, I can't fill it, I can't fill it. There's a hole in my soul, can you feel it? Can you feel it? You have always worn your flaws upon your sleeve, and I have always buried them deep beneath the ground. Dig them up, let's finish what we started. Dig them up so nothing's left unturned. It goes on from there, and I wonder. Well, really, I've stopped wondering and I've decided that it will be those whose struggles are in the forefront of American life right now, whose very existence is the filling of the holes in our collective soul. America was never America to me, Langston Hughes said in his famous poem that I believe Susan read right here just a few weeks ago on Independence Weekend. America was never America to me. I am America, the part you won't recognize, Muhammad Ali wrote or said. We cannot fill the holes in our story, in our soul, and become whole, become America, without lifting, not just mentioning and talking about, but really, truly lifting the lives of the Americans for whom America is yet to be America. We get closer to being America when we lift the lives of people who are gay, lesbian, bisexual, pansexual, asexual, transgender, intersex, and all the unspecified ways of being queer. We have never been America without them, and we never will be. And it takes more than bumper stickers. It takes deliberate actions of lifting their voices, sometimes above other voices, because for too long they have been silenced altogether. It takes not just looking at a sweet old man like Muhammad Ali and making accommodations for his disabled body because he's a national treasure, but it takes making space for and lifting the voices of all people with disabilities, even above our own voices, even at the expense of our own beloved Unitarian Universalist metaphors sometimes, because simply for too long they have been silenced altogether. And sometimes right here in our very humanist-leaning Unitarian Universalism, we need to do Quran readings until we're squirming in our chairs with discomfort. And I almost picked a reading from the Quran today, but the service is only supposed to last about an hour, so stay tuned for another week. But let's talk about our Islamic siblings for a minute here anyway. So you all know me well enough to know that stories are how I experience deep truth to its fullest. And so I'm going to tell you a short story about why my Pentecost-loving soul has begun to fall in love with Islam. And why my full reading of the Quran during the month of Ramadan that has recently ended was so good for me and hopefully for those with whom I will interact. I could tell you several stories of how my fellow Americans who are Muslim are changing my life for good. But I'll share just this one, and it's a story that many of you have heard because I've told it from right here. A few years ago, I was teaching downstairs here at this church in the neighboring faiths program for fourth and fifth graders, I believe it was. And so we were preparing to visit our local Muslim community center and their newly dedicated mosque or masjid, and we'd been studying Islam in class for a couple of weeks, particularly about how to be a good guest in Muslim worship spaces. And so we had instructed our students as a part of that program that traditionally people who are not of the same gender and not related to each other do not touch each other physically in the Muslim community. And we didn't know how traditional the folks at the Rockford Muslim Association are in practice, so to be on the safe side, we had instructed them exactly that. Generally, no handshakes between men and women. Which is easy enough with shy tweens, actually. I didn't worry much about that. So the day came for the visit, and for which, incidentally, the women of the masjid had made us a pancake smorgasbord that was a religious experience in and of itself. So our caravan arrived in their parking lot, and several people were standing outside the front door awaiting us to greet us. And the imam himself walked out to meet us in the parking lot at our vehicles. And so one of the moms who was chaperoning our youth forgot our instructions about the touching thing. And she reached out her hand to shake the hand of the imam as she introduced herself. And almost as quickly as she did it, she remembered. And she began to pull her hand back. It was kind of like, and in that moment, the imam was quicker. He reached out his hand immediately and took hers in both of his and looked straight into her eyes and with a smile said, "It's okay, sister. If we must err, let's always err on the side of friendship." I wonder when I will begin to always err on the side of friendship, even when it means sometimes that angry, hurting people will hurt me. I wonder when my beloved Unitarian Universalism will begin to always err on the side of friendship, even when it means interfaith coalitions for good causes with people whose politics just make us cringe. I wonder when America will begin to always err on the side of friendship, even when it means our freedom of religion really does mean all religion. All freedom, and we are all one America. Television reporter and interviewer Gil Noble said everybody was plugged into this man because he was taking on America. There had never been anybody in his position who directly addressed himself to racism. Racism was virulent, but you didn't talk about those things. If you wanted to make it in this country, you had to be quiet, carry yourself in a certain way, and not say anything about what was going on, even though there was a knife sticking in your chest. Ali changed all of that. He talked about racism and slavery and all of that stuff. And everybody who was black, whether they said it overtly or covertly, said, "Amen." But Ali's appeal was extending far beyond black America, Noble continues to write. When he refused induction into the United States Army, he stood up to armies everywhere in support of the proposition that unless you have a very good reason to kill, war is wrong. Many Americans vehemently condemned Ali's stand. It came at a time when most people in the United States still supported the war. But as Julian Bond noted, when Ali refused to take the symbolic step forward, everybody knew about it moments later. You could hear people talking about it on the street corners. It was on everyone's lips. The government didn't need Ali to fight the war, Ramsey Clark, then the Attorney General of the United States, recalled. But they would have loved to put him in service, get his picture in there, maybe give him a couple of stripes on his sleeve and take him all over the world. Think of the power that would have had in Africa, Asia, South America, where he was beloved. Instead, the government got a reaffirmation of Ali's earlier statement, "I ain't got no quarrel with them Viet Cong." And that rang serious alarm bells, sociologist Noam Chomsky wrote later, because it raised the question of why poor people in the United States were being forced by rich people in the United States to kill poor people in Vietnam. Putting it simply, that's what it amounted to, and Ali put it very simply in ways that most people could understand. Ali's refusal to accept induction placed him once and for all in the vortex of the 1960s. You had riots in the streets, you had assassinations, you had the war in Vietnam, journalist David Kindred remembered. It was a violent, turbulent, almost indecipherable time in America. And Ali was in all of those fires at once, in addition to being the heavyweight champion of the world. All of these words were by journalist Thomas Hauser. So, my dear family, I'm still confused. I still have more questions than answers, but that's okay because I actually think that's what's expected in our beloved faith. But as I said in that post just a few days after Ali died, I want to talk about it. I'm bewildered, as are many of us, by the misguided notion of making America great again. But I'm interested in the notion of making America, America, to my fellow citizens, my fellow human beings for whom America has never been America. When I first preached a version of this sermon at Tree of Life UU in McHenry, it was the weekend for patriotism and fireworks and parades and soul-stirring Sousa anthems. And you know, I'm really cool with all of that. That's fine. It's not wrong that we give honor where honor is due, and we are really, really an interesting experiment of a thing, we Americans. We're worth celebrating. And we really do keep getting better and better, and yet we still sugarcoat the things that have kept us from being ever truly great. So maybe the political and moral crossroads at which we find ourselves right now is exactly where we're supposed to be if we are to keep getting better. Dig them up, let's finish what we started. Dig them up so nothing's left unturned. All of your flaws and all of my flaws, the part you won't recognize. We cannot ever recognize who we do not acknowledge, whose faces we do not look deeply into, even when, especially when, it's very, very uncomfortable. I cannot really recognize you as a part of me if I refuse to understand your holy text or listen to your story of being afraid to use the bathroom that fits with the truth of who you are, or if I sit with you in the hospital and advocate for the fair treatment of your black son. If I refuse to eat at that restaurant that I like because I know that your wheelchair or your autistic daughter won't fit in there. It's uncomfortable to change. It's uncomfortable to change the words to hymns that don't include us all. Heck, earlier in the service, we sang this really uplifting hymn about we'll build a land. It had gender binary written right into it, and I picked out that song myself. It's not always easy. It's not always comfortable. It's messy, and we're gonna get it wrong sometimes, but that doesn't mean we don't try and try better and try better again until we get it right. The parts of us that we don't recognize are here anyway, and they're not going away. I am America. I am the part you won't recognize, but get used to me. And thank all that is holy for Americans like Muhammad Ali for refusing to be invisible, for refusing to sit down and stop rocking the boat. For those that got into the ring, stayed in the fight, refused to tap out, and made us recognize, and made us all step up our game, and made us all stronger. May we continue to grow and learn from each other. Together in love is the only way forward. So may it be, and amen.